It's in Boston, 72 degrees.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You don't want to hear it, but science Bigfoot Martin Rees is here to tell you humankind will be lucky to survive this century. Tonight, he lays out the odds of cataclysm by bioterror, global warming, nuclear megaterrorism, genetic tampering, the gray goo theory, and more. And then we bring in a theologian to ask, in the name of God and science, what are we supposed to do with this information? Tonight on Point, speaking the unspeakable, Doomsday. We begin tonight in Krakow, Poland, where just hours ago, Air Force One touched down on the first stop of President Bush's whirlwind overseas trip. In Evian, France, the president will attend the G8 summit, where he'll be face-to-face with French President Jacques Chirac for the first time since the French leader and others in attendance denounced the war against Iraq. Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and is traveling with the president. I asked her about the real work ahead at the G8 summit.
Well, the real work of the G8 meeting is to try and mend together a transatlantic relationship that was terribly frayed by the war in Iraq. About half the G8 members opposed the war, about half supported it. What the president wants to do is lay out a series of proposals and initiatives that everyone can agree on at this point and can work on cooperatively to try to repair that relationship.
So is that work on the agenda, or is it just woven through? Is it just the meaning of all the other steps?
It's going to be mostly in the atmospherics of the meeting. The actual business on the table is fairly, as they say in diplomatic parlance, pre-cooked. Mm-hmm. A bunch of trade initiatives, aid for Africa, developing nations, that kind of thing. But the important work of the summit is going to be just the warmth of the greetings that the leaders can give to each other, and whether there develops a sense that Iraq is now in the past.
And is there a sense going into the G8 meeting that this outcome of mended relations is a sure thing?
Well, I think most people feel that everybody who's going to be at the table has more at stake in patching the relationship up than in continuing their disagreements.
France, Germany, Russia, Canada all opposed the war in Iraq. Has there been spade work done in advance of Monday's meeting to get these relationships back on track?
Oh, yes, there's been a lot of spade work. There's been a lot of meetings between lower-level officials. There's been phone calls back and forth. I don't think that there's any doubt at this point that Bush and Chirac in particular will be very cordial to each other. One thing to keep in mind is that President Bush is delivering a speech tomorrow, Saturday, in Poland on the transatlantic relationship in which he is going to lay out his vision of where to go from here. It's a kind of blueprint in which he will recognize that there were disagreements over Iraq and that we can agree to disagree about what was in the past, but that it's very important now to move forward. And I think that will really set the tone then for what will happen in the G8 in Evian in France.
Does he plan to present himself as the magnanimous Bush or the imperious Bush?
I suppose somewhere in between. The reason is he's just had a tremendous success on the world stage.
And he's not going to apologize for it.
No, and he certainly does not feel that he has anything to apologize for, and he won't. There is a certain diplomatic finesse that needs to be done here. He can't rub our allies' nose in that. But on the other hand, he wants to say, look, I was right, but I'm going to be a gracious winner, and now let's just all play ball again.
The G8 summit is to last 3 days. President Bush will be there for just over 24 hours. Is that seen as a slight by the heads of state who will be there?
It could have been, but the White House did a lot of work to convince them that it's not. What he's cutting it short to do is something that Europeans have long urged Bush to do, and that is to take the lead on trying to forge some kind of peace in the Middle East. And so the fact that he's cutting the visit short specifically to do this, I think, in their mind is legitimate and a very welcome development.
Maura, have you seen or been briefed on steps in protocol that have been arranged to try and rebuild bridges, to mend fences here? Are there specific toasts or dances or moments that are constructed to help this along?
Well, I can assure you that there has been a tremendous amount of work done on precisely that kind of thing. Although they do not want this trip to come across as stilted or staged. So there's a delicate job to do between trying to choreograph too much camaraderie and just letting things flow naturally on their own.
And at that theater of statecraft level, is there any moment you're anticipating at which President Bush may, even by nuance, show his disgruntlement with France?
I think everyone will be watching his behavior very carefully as he greets Chirac. This will be the first time the two leaders have seen each other since the Iraq War. And there will be a tremendous amount of attention paid to their body language, to how wide their smiles are, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anybody expects any little digs on Bush's part. He's been trying to send a message that he wants to move forward. I mean, he gave an interview with French journalists yesterday in which he, you know, made it very clear that while he was not happy with France's stance, that he's not holding it against the nation as a whole, and that he does see France as a longtime valuable ally, and that it's time to let bygones be bygones.
We heard at one point that President Bush was not going to spend a night in France. Was that just an urban legend, or is he going to be camping out with all the rest of the G8 leaders?
What that came from was an original plan for Bush to stay in Geneva in Switzerland. Evian is just a few miles inside France from Switzerland, and it was thought for security reasons it might be better for Bush to stay in Switzerland, and some within the administration were looking for subtle ways to make a few digs at France, but that was weeks and months ago. The idea that Bush would not even spend the night in the host country of the G8 was just too much of a diplomatic affront.
And more finally, we know that there are Europeans who are eager to get this thing back on track. Is there a sense in the Bush White House that they also need mended relations with Europe?
I think that there is a sense, at least in some parts of the White House and the administration, that certain tasks in the future will be easier for the United States with European help than without it. I mean, the fact of the matter is the United States is the most powerful nation in the world. But there's a lot of things we don't want to do militarily, and there's a lot of, for instance, peacekeeping and nation-building tasks for which we're just not particularly well-suited. And I think there is a growing realization in the White House and in at least some parts of the administration that we're better off with the Europeans than without them.
Well, we'll be watching this upcoming minuet. Maura Reynolds, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and is traveling with President Bush. She spoke with me from Krakow, Poland. The New York Times calls him one of the world's most brilliant cosmologists. Martin Rees is Britain's royal astronomer and a much-honored professor at Cambridge University. When a scientist of his renown is giving human beings just a 50-50 chance of making it through this century, it's time to pay attention. His new book is a crisp catalog of mega threats and a cool calculation that they may take us all down and soon maybe end all life on Earth, all life in the universe. When we read that, we fell to our knees and called a theologian, not for last rites or absolution. We're still fighting here, but for a cosmic take on how to find the courage, the fortitude, to take on what Martin Rees is saying and deal with it. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to believe in a 50-50 chance humankind will survive this century? Is this Chicken Little, or is this real? And if it is, how do we get real about it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Later in this hour, we'll be joined by distinguished theologian and ethicist Ted Peters. Right now, I'm joined by Sir Martin Rees, Astronomer Royal of the United Kingdom, Royal Society Professor at Cambridge, Fellow of King's College, winner of too many prizes to list here, member of the National Academy of Sciences, and author of Our Final Hour, A Scientist's Warning, How Terror, Error, and Environmental Disaster Threaten Humankind's Future in This Century on Earth and Beyond. Martin Rees is visiting the United States and joins us tonight from State College, Pennsylvania. Good evening and welcome, Martin Rees.
Good evening. Glad to be on the program.
Very glad to have you. Martin Rees, you say that the 21st century could be the critical era in which life on Earth spreads beyond our solar system, or just as likely that we have endangered the future of human life on the planet, human life in the entire universe. That's a pretty broad range of possibilities. What are you saying here?
Well, that is the broad range. I think I'm not quite as pessimistic as you imply, in that I think there's a 50% chance of a real setback to civilization. I think the chance of an ultimate catastrophe wiping us out is much smaller than that. So let's not be too gloomy at the start, but I am concerned that this century is a pivotal century because we are exposed not just to the threat of nuclear war that's still with us, but to newer and more intractable threats of all kinds stemming from science and its misuse. So I think there are a big variety of threats that will be hard to contend with.
Yeah, I guess so. You point this out as a kind of crucial juncture. You say in the book, it may not be absurd hyperbole. Indeed, it may not even be an overstatement to assert that the most crucial location in space and time, apart from the Big Bang itself, could be here and now. And you go on to list a pretty intimidating lineup of threats to, yes, as you say, at one level, human civilization and potential damage that could be done there, but also, as I read your book, at another level, to human life itself, even life in the entire universe.
Indeed, there are some threats like that, but the main point I'm making is that we have some things which are going to change in this century in a way they never changed before. One obvious one is human nature itself. Over the thousands of years of human history, the one thing that's been constant has been human nature, but with genetic engineering, targeted drugs, and maybe even implants into the brain, human beings themselves may change, and that's an uncertainty we've got to factor in this century, in addition to all the normal uncertainties of foretelling the future. And just to go on from that, I think in the next 10 or 20 years, obviously there's a severe threat to the fabric of society in countries like the United States from misuse of biological knowledge. I quote in my book a report from the National Academy of Sciences, which emphasized how this new knowledge would empower small groups or even individuals with the capacity to cause real devastation, which would have a real effect on society, a backlash against science, etc. That's a short-term threat, but of course, if we read some futurologists who live in California mainly, they will tell us about things that may happen 50 years from now, superintelligent machines, nano machines going riot, etc. And those threats are still science fiction now, but 50 years from now they may not be.
Is that the end of the range at which you have us into tearing the fabric of space itself? I mean, you've got everything here from kind of the traditional calamities of deluge and earthquake,
yes,
through the ones we've known for decades now of nuclear catastrophe, to the immediate future, biological and terror-wise, and then on into experiments gone bad that could actually rip up the universe itself, if I got that right, Martin Rees.
That's something which people have speculated about. I think that's very, very unlikely. But I did mention the possibility that something like this could happen because I think it does indicate an important point of principle about science, which is that if scientists do an experiment or introduce something new, they've got to be very careful and they've got to reassure the public that the downside is not something that we should be too concerned about.
So out of all this, you come up with a 50-50 odds that civilization will destroy itself in this century. You're a scientist. How do you come up with odds like that?
Well, obviously, it's an uncertain estimate, but let me just say why I don't think it's being too pessimistic. Let's think of nuclear war. Over the decades of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there was a threat of a nuclear war, which could have been devastating for the Northern Hemisphere. Let's not forget that the arsenals of the United States and the former Soviet Union were equivalent to one of the U.S. Air Force's fearsome daisy cutter bombs, mm-hmm. the kind used in Afghanistan, for every single citizen. And if that had gone off, that would have been devastation in the Northern Hemisphere. And if we read about what happened in the Cuba crisis and other crises, then I think the chance that we might have had a catastrophe on those occasions was maybe 20%.
We're going to come back and look at the odds right now. Martin Rees calculates them in a pretty grim fashion. The odds of human civilization surviving this century we're talking about tonight and the human struggle to make sense of the risk of doom. Can you manage the notion that human civilization may well not survive this century? And with or without Martin Rees, do you live with a sneaking suspicion that we are flirting with apocalypse? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
287.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the odds of human civilization surviving this century and the human struggle to make sense of the risk of doom. My guest tonight is Sir Martin Rees. He's Britain's Royal Astronomer, Professor of Astronomy at Cambridge University, one of the world's leading cosmologists, and author of Our Final Hour, A Scientist's Warning, wherein he warns of a 50-50 chance that humankind may not survive in any form that we know it to the end of the century that we're in. You can join this conversation. Is this just more Chicken Little, the eternal doomsday warning, or are we living with a new level of cataclysmic risk? Is doomsday risk the unspeakable backdrop of contemporary life, or do you feel overwhelmed with warnings? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Martin Rees, I have a feeling that all that's on your mind and all that's in your book is somehow in the backs of many people's minds these days. I just saw the cover of the New Yorker magazine this week. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a marvelous drawing of a New York scene, street scene. On the street, there are pedestrians holding their eyes and their ears, and they're in a panic and doom-laden looks on their faces. And above them, there's a skyscraper going up. They're putting on the top, teeny top bit, just way up high. When you look more closely, you see it's a house of cards. This notion of the world and all we know as a house of cards is in the air. But is it scientific?
I think it is, because, as I was saying, the nuclear threat, which was the worst threat we had, hasn't gone away. It may reappear, but there are new threats, and also our society is more vulnerable. We know that even a minor scare, which fortunately has few fatalities, like the anthrax scare, can cause a real national effect on the psyche. And I think that does mean that we are in a state when society is rather vulnerable, as you say, and this century is, I think, more threatening than centuries before. I think Jeremiah's in the past have been proved wrong, but I would say, to give another cartoon, there's a story of the man falling off the skyscraper and saying, as he passed the 10th floor, it's all right so far. It was, but it won't remain so, and I feel that may be the situation for us.
You've begun to take us through some of these this catalog of horrible possibilities, and a lot of them we know well. Some since civilization began, and before others, as we said, in the last few decades, bioterrorism we think we've begun to have a handle on. But you write about the democratization of technologies that will put super destructive technologies in the hands of just about any, in the hands of, as you describe them, weirdos who could pull it all down. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that every society has its weirdos and disaffected people, and we know that they have been able to cause serious incidents, the Oklahoma bomber you had and the Unabomber and people like that, as well as other cults. And empowered by modern technology, they can cause more devastation. And my genuine concern is less with organized terrorist groups, but with individuals with the mindset of those who now design computer viruses, or the mindset of an arsonist. And such people with expertise in modern technology are going to be more dangerous to us, and even one, maybe too many in our society. That's my concern.
You also write about scientific experiments going awry, and I wonder if you could be a bit more concrete in a few examples of what where your concerns might lie there.
Well, I mean, obviously scientists know they have to be very careful in doing experiments on dangerous pathogens to make sure they don't escape. We always worry about that, and they're very careful. And also, whenever you do an experiment that produces conditions that have never happened before, then you might wonder what might happen. And I mentioned some experiments that have been done that create conditions that never existed in the universe since the Big Bang. And we don't quite know what would happen. In that case, I think the scientists were very careful. They thought very hard what the risks were before going ahead. But always, when there's a catastrophic downside, we've got to convince ourselves as scientists, and more important, convince the wide public, that there's no severe risk.
And at the worst, you describe a scenario where the atoms of all that is begin to tear apart, and that the universe itself is ripped, that life, which may only be on Earth, is extinguished here, and the universe is torn up and there's no life anywhere. Pretty grim.
Well, I mean, that's a scenario some people have speculated about. I think that the chance of that is less than one in a billion, and so I don't worry about it. But I think it's very important that before we do experiments that could have that consequence, we make sure that the chances that they do is well below one in a billion.
So when you sit down with fellow scientists and they see you're out there now with a popular book talking about 50-50 chances of civilization surviving, do they tut-tut with you and say, oh, Martin, you're over the top, you're just selling books? Or do they say, you're saying what we don't have the courage to say?
No, I've been surprised at how many do share my pessimism, because a 50% chance of something going seriously wrong with civilization, as I say, is something which I predict even on the basis of nuclear war. And we add together all these other risks, which are harder to predict, and I think I'm not being unduly pessimistic. Some people, of course, are, I would say, in denial, but many of them, I think, believe we are entering a risky century.
And very quickly, because I want to turn to our theologian, but you say ways out of this, kind of number one on your list is humans need to get off this planet and colonize other planets, perhaps other solar systems, as soon as possible.
Well, let me say, I hope that will happen, but that's not a way out. Only a tiny fraction of adventurers will ever get beyond our Earth. So that would prevent the demise of our species, but it's not a solution for the rest of us, I don't think.
Certainly not in any near term, but speaking of the species there, for the rest of us, you have some radical proposals here. Among them, the complete end to privacy and the absolute transparency of every individual's life and every government action, every institutional action, so that everything could be tracked, so that the democratization of technology doesn't put it in the hands of someone who blows it all up.
Well, I'm quoting a book by David Brin, the science fiction writer, who did propose that. And what I'm saying is that if there is a threat from lone weirdos, as it were, then I think there'd be pressure for more intrusive surveillance. And so the nightmare that David Brin proposed may be something which may come to seem almost the lesser of the evils.
A nightmare that may turn out to be a strange saving grace. Martin Rees, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Ted Peters. He's joining us from Berkeley, California. He's professor of theology at the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences. It's affiliated with the University of California, Berkeley, and a professor at the Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. He's author of Playing God, Genetic Determinism and Human Freedom. Good evening and welcome, Ted Peters.
Tom, good to be with you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Ted Peters, Martin Rees has put a big challenge out there through the publishing channel, put out this 50-50 chance of surviving this century. And when we read this here at On Point, we thought to ourselves, you know, it's not enough to talk just about the threats and the odds. We need to talk about a path to taking this on board, if indeed this is a real risk. And for some reason, the language was so apocalyptic, we wanted to turn to a theologian. What goes through your mind when you hear this kind of dire prediction about what may be?
Well, I certainly appreciate the scientific prophecy of a fine scientist like Dr. Rees. And yes, we need, as a civilization, to take seriously these forewarnings, just as the prophets in ancient Israel, of course, had forewarned the people of Israel. There are always two dimensions, and Dr. Rees is very aware of both of them. On the one hand, you make a forecast or you make a prediction that certain things could happen, and some of them could have dire consequences. And at the same time, you pose the ethical challenge that it is our responsibility to anticipate these things and to make the right decisions in order to guide our society in a healthy direction.
We don't want to skip past the myriad steps that could, might, we hope will be taken to forestall all of this. But our sense here is that human beings are somehow not richly equipped to deal with this sort of risk and threat level at all, that we tend to shut down our contemplation of it. It's too awkward, too difficult to acknowledge, which is what led us to theology, is a sense that maybe this is a path to taking on issues of this scale. But is theology, in this case, Ted Peters, does it tend to be a kind of anesthesia or a door to recognizing the profound?
Well, that's a very important 20th century question. Karl Marx and the Marxists had tried to describe religion as the opiate of the people, the kind of narcotic that sues people into inaction when they're unable to handle things. My own observation in history is that just the opposite is the case, is that religions coming out of the Bible that anticipate a future new creation, tend to be more vigorous in inspiring people to take responsibility. In fact, these are the religions that look for transformation in the world. So I have a hunch that the kinds of challenges that we're talking about will be greeted by Jews and Christians in particular as the kinds of realities that we must deal with, and we'll look for the resources to be responsible as we take them on board.
Martin Rees, let me turn it to you. What kind of response do you find from readers and those that you speak with and lecture to when you lay out this buffet of potential horrors and the very difficult arresting odds? How do people respond? And are humans as a race able to take on this sort of odds calculation, this sort of challenge?
Well, some people say that perhaps the answer is to put a stop to science and innovation. And I try to argue that's not realistic or desirable because science still offers tremendous benefits, and we don't want to lose those, and we can't selectively stop some discoveries without denying ourselves benefits. So I try and say that's not an easy way out. And I'm afraid I'm going to agree with Dr. Peters that a spiritual dimension is essential. And obviously, if we can minimize the likelihood that people will misuse science, then clearly we'll be safer. And we are already confronted with a lot of ethical issues from modern science, particularly biology and medicine. And it's very important to draw in ethicists and theologians and not leave this to scientists.
But I'm curious about that spiritual element. Ted Peters mentions Christians and Jews as probably being inspired to do something by this. Have you found that to be the case, that people of some religions are more apt than others to take action or to acknowledge in response to what you hear?
To be honest, I haven't. I mean, I quote as a very inspiring example many of those involved in making the first atomic bombs at Los Alamos, who devoted their later lives to searches for means towards disarmament. I don't think they were of any particular religious belief. I think it's surprising how little connection there is between actual socially desirable action and religious belief.
And Ted Peters, how about the same question? Does religion actually inspire humans to come to grips with these issues, to pull them out of the margins of thought into sort of deliberate thought? Or, I mean, Christianity certainly has an end-of-days scenario ready and waiting.
I think I'm going to answer yes to that. And there are two kinds of religion. One is the kind that belongs to institutions, churches, and synagogues and things like that. And that's the kind that I'm involved with as a theology professor. But there's also religion that is that nobody owns, that just pervades the culture. It's kind of the deep source of values that orient us. And those scientists who worked on developing the atomic bomb at Los Alamos in the late 1930s and early 1940s, even though there were a variety of religious affiliations, those people were religious in the general Western cultural sense, and inspired in part by Albert Einstein and by some of the others, they felt that they wanted their science to work for world peace, and they genuinely did that, even though history, of course, played a mighty dirty trick on all of us. But you mentioned specifically the Christian vision of the future that we find in the apocalypse. And on the one hand, it understands that human nature is capable of horrendous evils, hence the imagery of the children of light battling the children of darkness and in apocalyptic thought. But beyond it, there's the dawn of light, there's the new creation, and that will be God's promised gift to the world.
But that's
so
on the other side of apocalypse.
We to the Christian religion that is just always going to be there.
Well, I want to come back and talk about that more, but callers want to join us, and I want to invite them in. Dana's calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Well, I would like to just say that, you know, given our hubris as a species, and both religion and science have a role in this, and I say this as a Christian, except for the ecological impact on other species, on the biosphere, I would say humanity does not deserve to survive. And I would not care if it, I would hope it wouldn't, if it weren't for the impact it would have on, like, we'd be bringing every other animal and plant down with us.
You mean you want to bring justice down on humans? You want the human race punished? Why?
Well, look at our record. Look how black this record is as a species on this planet. I mean, look at the untold suffering, the pushing other animals to the brink of extinction. We rape wilderness areas to replace them with strip malls, and we're polluting. We're the ones that created the atomic bombs, you know, not the fish, not the dogs.
And still, I'd like to stick around with all that we bring as well, Dana, but let me put it to our guest, and thanks for your call. Martin Rees, how about it? You also describe humans as, in some sense, very much the problem.
I do, but I'd like to put forward a sort of secular vision, which perhaps astronomers have more than others, and that is that we should not see humans as being the culmination of evolution. We are aware, as astronomers, that the time lying ahead is as long as the billions of years that have led to our emergence via natural selection, and one reason I want to preserve our species is, of course, that I'm a member of it, but another reason is that if we were to destroy ourselves, we'd foreclose the potential of post-human evolution, which could in principle be just as long as the evolution in the past. So I think even the most misanthropic person among us should want to preserve our species, because we may lead to something better. If you imagine the first animal that crawled onto dry land 300 million years ago, it may have been an ugly brute, but if you'd clobbered it, you'd have destroyed the potentiality of all the land animals. And likewise, whatever you think of human beings, then you wouldn't want to destroy the post-human future that could be far more glorious than any human future.
And when you put this century in the same tiny category of elite moments with the Big Bang,
yes,
it would seem to put a pretty high importance, significance on some very rapid evolution right now to survive it.
Well, I mean, we could foreclose all that future evolution if we handle things badly this century. That's my point.
Ted Peters, are we up to it?
Tom, I like the way you saw the justice issue in the way Dana posed that question. It's as if we have unjustly treated the natural world and we should be punished for it. I think I'd rather use the model of repentance and renewal here. Even though we may have polluted our planet in the past, I think our responsibility is to care for the Earth in the future. I'd much rather see that than to do away with the human species.
Let's do it. Ted Peters, Martin Rees, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the odds of human civilization surviving this century and the human struggle to make sense of the risk of doom. Is doomsday risk the unspeakable backdrop of contemporary life, or do you feel overwhelmed with warnings? Does the risk give daily reality the feeling of unreality? As we feed the 401k and top up the SUV, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
R.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the odds of human civilization surviving this century and the human struggle to make sense of the risk of doom. Our guest tonight, Sir Martin Rees, is Britain's Royal Astronomer, Professor of Astronomy at Cambridge University, one of the leading cosmologists in the world, and author of the new book, Our Final Hour, A Scientist's Warning, How Terror, Error, and Environmental Disaster Threaten Humankind's Future in This Century on Earth and Beyond. We're also joined tonight by Ted Peters, joining us from Berkeley, California. He's professor of theology at the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences. You can join us, too. Is this just more Chicken Little, the eternal doomsday warning, or are we living with an urgent new level of cataclysmic risk? Is theology an anesthetic here, or possibly a path of access to the scale of these issues? And I guess, is the human race up to the challenge of this century? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Melanie's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Melanie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Dr. Rees, I find your argument certainly very plausible. I'm sympathetic to, you know, the gist of your argument. I'm just wondering if you could take us through in layman's term a little bit about the measurement. Where do you come up with the numbers 50% and that sort of thing?
Yes. Well, obviously, it's hard to predict 100 years ahead. I would say that based on our experience of nuclear war and the threats of the Cuba crisis, etc., and the realization that these nuclear weapons still exist and will exist for the next 100 years, I think the risk of a devastating nuclear war is probably 50% in this century.
You quote President Kennedy as saying that in the Cuban Missile Crisis, the threat was, the odds were 1 in 3.
He said once it was 1 in 3 and
of nuclear war.
Yeah, and other people have said we were on a hair trigger at the Cuba crisis.
So to Melanie's point, you draw a kind of baseline there and go up. How do you kick it on up to 50-50?
Well, I mean, if we look 100 years from now, then there could be new standoffs between superpowers, maybe the U.S. and China or others, and I would have thought that threat alone would be higher in the future than it was in the past. That could get us near to 50-50. But then we have this whole variety of unpredictable new threats. It's not a precise estimate, but I would not give better odds than 50-50 for our survival without some severe setback due to some kind of new technology.
Melanie, is that good enough for you to buy into the risk threat as described here in these odds?
Well, I mean, I'm coming from this from the perspective of a social scientist, so if we're talking strict sort of measurement terms,
yeah,
then I guess not. But I think
it's just betting odds. It's no more than that. But,
right,
you know, if you think that we were quite lucky to get through the Cold War without a nuclear threat, and then we've got nuclear threats plus all these others, then I think you'd have to be very optimistic to bet better than evens.
Melanie, let me ask you, if you're a social scientist, how do you imagine that humans sort of hold this kind of idea in mind, that scale of threat?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a difficult question, but I'm sympathetic with the comments you made earlier that humans just cannot handle this sort of threat. I mean, they come up with a variety of coping mechanisms. So I'm not sure that humans can sort of bear that risk in mind and go through life on a day-to-day basis. Now, there are ways to channel that, and I think the comments earlier about looking at this in terms of redemption are one positive sort of direction.
A direction that would lead to material steps that might forestall this kind of outcome?
Certainly. I mean, there are very concrete steps. The question is, it sort of becomes a collective action issue. How do you mobilize large groups of people around these issues to make them see that the odds are somewhere around 50-50 and take appropriate action?
But what would redemption lead to in your mind, Melanie, other than people falling to their knees and praying?
Oh, I'm looking at it in a sort of different way,
mm-hmm,
in redemption in sort of ecological terms, in terms of concrete steps towards one sort of little issue would be recycling. But
so let's step up and redeem the error of our ways, sort of redemption.
Right. I mean, work in scientific ways towards reducing these threats that we've created, because they're not irreversible.
Absolutely. Melanie, thank you so much for your call. Peter's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I think Thomas Jefferson had it right when he wrote that he felt that religion prior to age 17 should not be taught, as in religious studies, because it's propaganda. And I believe that religion is really at the core root of the world's instability. The self-righteous Israelis, our self-righteous president, good and evil, about being able to take complex topics and frame them like a grade school kid.
What about self-righteous Muslims who take down tall towers full of people?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's the idea that it chains your mind, and it can frame things in such simplistic ways. And let us not forget what's going to happen June 2nd, when they're talking about consolidation of the media and Clear Channel Communications held pro-war rallies with religious leaders.
Peter, I want to stay right on this point of religion for a moment. We take that, and we've talked about that on this show, and we'll talk about it again. It's a big deal, we acknowledge. But I want to ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
We brought religion in here tonight through Ted Peters, just out of the sense that maybe the secular day-in and day-out life that most people live may not prepare them to take on a challenge of the scope that Martin Rees describes. What do you say?
Well, here's what I say. As we talk about it, we're talking about a very unique view, and that's the view of Americans who real religion is consumer products. And I think that when people start losing their jobs and they start looking at, you know, this is not the thing that's ultimately going to give us an identity in this planet. It's going to come, I think, when increasingly the credit card debt in this country is much larger than any other country on the planet. We have, many multiples of a combination of the top militaries in terms of expenditure. And when this continues as a trend, I don't think it's going to be possible for people, changing careers, not only jobs but careers multiple times in their lifetime.
Peter, we've got it. We're talking about many kinds of sustainability there, but I want to take your core point to Ted Peters, Ted, and this is the challenge that religion, to boil it down, maybe hasn't led humankind to stand up and fix all this, to redeem itself from what's brought us to this pass, and in Peter's view, won't.
Well, I would agree with Peter that living life at the level of the credit card will not lead to a healthy soul, but I think his judgment on history is probably less than accurate. It's really out of the religious traditions that we've gotten such things as the Humane Society and concerns for the environment and the kinds of ethical visions that our wider society and culture needs and continues to draw its strength from. I'd like to pick up on your interaction with Melanie there on the question of whether or not our psyche is able to handle this overload of challenges. In many ways, that was the thesis of Alvin Toffler's work back in 1970, Future Shock. There's just too much coming at us and we can't handle it all. I think probably what conscientious people do in that situation is rather than eat the whole pie, they just cut out one slice and try to take that on. And I was just thinking about, what was happening at the time of Alvin Toffler were the big discussions about the SSQ, the SST. Should we have a supersonic transport plane because it would destroy the ozone layer? Mm-hmm. And there were conscientious people that argued against it. And if you may remember, the United States decided it would not manufacture these SSTs because it would destroy the ozone layer. Well, other countries went ahead, and sure enough, the ozone layer has been compromised because of these airplanes.
So what are you suggesting with that,
Ted? That would be an example of a bite-sized attempt to do the right thing, even though it failed.
But Martin Rees is talking about a kind of a wholesale revision of society that may be required to counter these things. I mean, for example, the idea of a fully transparent human society where there was nothing that was private or secret anymore because we couldn't afford to have anything secreted. That's a revolution in human social interaction.
Yeah, that's a Brave New World 1984 kind of scenario, and it's born out of fear and born out of anxiety, but there's a realism.
Maybe it's born out of logic.
Dr. Rees does have realism at a certain level when you think about people making atomic bombs in their garages. And, yeah, we need to face that.
Chris is calling from Abington, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I called you a while ago, and I said that I thought if you had a whole lot more surveillance, you could keep things in control. Other than that, things are going to get out of hand. And I think this is generally what this guy's saying. And you were talking about nobody wants to talk about these things. I guess it's just us psychos, right? But now what I'm saying is, if you have a religion that dominates all the society and can keep everybody in order and do the right thing, perhaps mankind can continue and not kill himself off, right? But
so get everybody in line somehow. But what we hear
somehow, and if the government is actually in charge of this, say the U.S. government, and they can actually keep a track of everybody, and that it becomes technically feasible with nanotechnology and all the things they're coming up with.
Sounds pretty grim, though, doesn't it, Chris? Thanks for your call, Martin Rees. How about it on this front of real solutions? Are you scientifically deadly serious about the notion of the necessity even for a transparent society, everything visible, everything out front?
Well, I'm not, but I think there's a trade-off between freedom and surveillance, and I think there's going to be pressure towards greater surveillance if people realize that this intractable threat is growing, and if they realize that even a few people who misuse technology could be too many. But I do share the view expressed by the other callers that what we really need is some change in our attitude so as to minimize the gross differentials between rich and poor, etc., because those are the kind of things that drive disaffection. And so I would hope that these concerns will motivate people and politicians to do what they should be doing anyway, namely to remedy the most obvious injustices. But it's very hard to get a consensus even on the most obvious things, and that is my reason for being depressed.
Martin Rees, in following on that, I wonder what your overall sense is when you look out at how humans are perceiving the century that we are in and what's coming. Is humankind too pessimistic or too optimistic?
Well, I think I'm moderately pessimistic, but I don't think that this is a tremendous pressure for the human psyche, because in the past, obviously, many individuals have lived their lives in far worse condition than they do now. What is special now is that we all on the earth are in this together, and if it's a catastrophe, it could affect the whole world.
Let's get one more call here. Bill's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to bring up the point is a couple points. It's number one, why are we approaching catastrophe? I mean, if science has helped us so much and technology has helped us so much, why are we approaching catastrophe? I think the reason is our social system of organizing, our money-based system, hasn't existed forever. And the social systems throughout history changed. There was feudalism, there was slavery, there's a money-based system. And as humans have changed, our system of organizing a world-based system has changed a lot.
Martin Rees says we may have less than a century. Can we adapt in that time, Bill?
I think that when problems become worse, new ideas for adapting will come up. I think our whole social organization will have to change because the level of technology is so high, we no longer need enough people for working. So our system of organizing will have to change. And I think that's the reason, because our social system has not changed and adapted to the technology, why we're having problems.
But here's a vote that we can do it, and we will do it. And I say, hear, hear for that.
Technology is changing faster and changing in new ways. So even human character is going to be changed by new technology. And so we do indeed have to adjust our society.
Do you think human character will change in a fashion, in a direction that makes it more likely that the species will adapt, cope here?
Well, again, I don't know, because it's hard to control the way these changes will be implemented. And my concern is that this will be an extra problem to contend with.
Well, it is quite an astonishing picture. Ted Peters, last word goes to you tonight. Are you praying your way out of this or voting your way out of this, or both?
Nature, human character will not change. What will change are the possibilities that we'll make the right decisions and take the right kinds of actions that will assure us a safe and prosperous and hopefully fulfilling future.
Well, let's get busy and get up on our toes and take care of it. Ted Peters, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Well, I enjoyed being with you, Tom.
Ted Peters joined us from Berkeley, California. He's professor of theology at the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences and at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. And Sir Martin Rees, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much. I hope my pessimism proves wrong.
I hope it proves motivating. Martin Rees is author of Our Final Hour, A Scientist Warning How Terror, Error, and Environmental Disaster Threaten Humankind's Future in This Century. You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.